Objectives of my talk are, number one, to provide some examples of CRISP impact, and I don't claim to have made an exhaustive list of all of those, but certainly some examples, to outline some gaps in our knowledge of CRISP impact, and I think there are some, and to discuss some ideas for increasing CRISP impact. And I think one of the key things to start with is to ask, What is impact? What is impact for a publicly supported program? And I think that impact, the only way to justify those taxpayer funds that are going into CRISP programs are to define it as benefits that are going to large numbers of ordinary people. What we're after here are replicable innovations. And the question is, how often do you replicate those? Those innovations might be in terms of yield, they might be in terms of higher profitability, higher incomes, they might be in terms of higher nutrition, better health, longer lifespans, environment, a long range of things. But the question is, how widespread are those benefits? And I think that we have to quantify those benefits, and that has big advantages for both the donors and for our own research management within universities and within other research organizations. It's also important to ask, what's not impact? And good PR alone is not impact. You might have good PR, which is not an impact at all. So we've all seen pictures of hungry children being refed with some product, and that's a good thing in itself. It's not impact. It may not affect a large number of people. And I think we have to be careful about what we claim in our PR to make sure that we built the foundations under it. And I'll tell you a little story. A few years ago, there was a plant breeder in a certain African country who was claiming that 20% of the area of this crop that he worked on was now being planted to varieties that he and his partners had developed. I was asked by the National Research Organization to work with them on an adoption study, and we found that, in fact, it was less than 1%. Now, he wasn't wrong. In the villages where he worked, it was over 20%. People loved his varieties. But he worked in 5 villages out of the maybe 2,000 villages in the main crop area where that crop was grown. And so one of the key issues is that variety was not getting out. But if you think about if PR had been done, public relations had been done based on that 20% claim, and the donor had gone to some villages that weren't the subject of their on-farm trials, this would have been a severe blow to the credibility of the organization. It may have wiped it out, because we have to be able to defend and to put a good foundation under our claims. Testimonials and anecdotal information are good ways to communicate impact. They are not impact in and of themselves. They can be used to put a human face on impact. They can be used to show people what is happening, but in themselves they're not impact. Achievements are things like students trained, articles published, varieties released. Again, those are intermediate products. They are not impact because they may not benefit people directly. Going to the last item on the list, we all know about varieties that have been released and have been actually planted by very few people. We all know about articles that have been published that were excellent science, but actually have not been applied for one reason or another. And then we need to ask about how we document impact. And I'm a bit of a fundamentalist about this issue in the sense that I think there's some very basic information that we're often lacking. And the key information is adoption rates. of technologies, of innovations, and whether that's varieties, whether that's a processing technology, whether that's a new way of organizing natural resource management. The question is, how many people are actually using it? And if you forget anything that I say this morning, remember that adoption rates are a key issue. And we can measure adoption rates in a variety of ways. We need to have usually two measures at least. One of them is the number of farmers or the number of households using a particular innovation, because that's key for social impact. We also need some measure of physical units, the percentage of area, the percentage of production that's processed or stored with a given technology, because that's needed for economic impact. The economic and financial measures are fairly cut and dried. The financial tools, net present value analysis, internal rates of return, annualized values, there's probably more agreement among ag economists, and I'm trained as an ag economist, among economists in general, on how to measure economic impact than there is on almost anything else. And economists are not noted as being a group that agrees on much, but there's a lot of agreement about that. And then there are other measures, indices of health, of nutrition, of environment, that are much less standardized, where there's a variety of ways of doing these sorts of measures, and that are very difficult to compare over time. So if you have a series of monetary benefits over time, it's quite easy, and there's a good framework for then calculating a net present value, an internal rate of return. If you have a series of height and weight measures for five-year-olds in a set of villages in Senegal, and how do you compare those changes over time? You can look at some trends and so on, but the systematic way of doing that is not nearly as well developed. Okay, so let's look at some examples. I'll start off with one that I worked on in the 1980s, being Cowpea Crisp and partners in Cameroon and Senegal developed a portfolio of non-chemical cowpea storage technologies. And so the question came up about 2002, 2003, what's the regional impact of those technologies? Those technologies were tested in the field. They were picked up by a number of NGOs and other organizations, but really what's happened to them? And so the specific objectives were to measure adoption, to look at economic impact, and then to identify opportunities for storage technology transfer. What was needed yet? Are we there? Have those technologies gone to all the people that can benefit from them, or do we need to do something else? Second thing I'd like you to remember: if you remember adoption rates, the next question is how do you measure those adoption rates? And I would argue the way you do that is you go, you take a random sample in the area where that technology is used, in the area where that crop is grown or that crop is processed. And I've heard, some people say, well, you can't take random samples in Africa. Well, you can, but it's a question of finding what's the culturally appropriate way to take a random sample in the community that you're in. And so this is a picture of my student, Bokar Musa. There's a child drawing a slip of paper out of a calabash with the name of a farmer on it. And in Niger, this is quite acceptable. This is the way they choose randomly the opponents in their traditional wrestling matches. And so people find that to be a fairly understandable way to approach this. And that's a key element in having credible results. So random choice of villages, random choice of farmers in those villages based on a list of farmers, and then looking at the impact using those fairly standard economic surplus and financial concepts. And so then you come up with data that looks like this, adoption, looking at adoption, and this happens to be a graph, an example of adoption among farmers, and so you see over there on your left, the ash. The ash is quite widely used in a couple of countries, in particular in Burkina and Cameroon, but the quantity of cowpea stored tends to be very small because the quantity of ash is quite limited. There's only so many trees to burn. If we go over on the other side of the graph, you see there's insecticides there, and Bean Cowpea Crisp didn't work on insecticides. We work specifically on non-chemical methods, but insecticides are out there. We need to compare ourselves to the other methodologies that are there. Using that data then, Bokar Musa, my student, did the economic analysis, so we come up with a net present value of about $186 million, and this is in seven countries, which represent about 96% of the cowpea grain production in West and Central Africa. An internal rate of return, about 27%. You can compare that, say, to your return on your TIA CREF account. If you got 27%, you'd feel, you know, like it was a pretty good year. Constraints. And a key thing that came out of this study was an identification of two main constraints. Number one is that farmers often don't understand the technology. And as a consequence, the failure rate is higher than it should be. And they tend to use storage insecticides as insurance. So they throw in a phostoxin capsule just because they're not sure that it'll work. Their failure rate is higher than it should be. The second one is, the second problem is the lack of appropriate containers. You know, any airtight container can work. In most parts of Africa, that means plastic bags. But finding the right plastic, heavy-duty plastic bags is a problem. In Burkina Faso, we found that farmers were using bags that the manufacturer had made for dry cleaning. You know, these flimsy bags that are over the outside of dry clean clothes, but that's what they had available. In part as a consequence of this study, the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation recognized that this was an important problem and there was an important upside benefit. And so they've invested $11.4 million in a project which will deal with those two constraints, training farmers and working with the plastic supply chain to develop better containers, better bags for African farmers to use. Another example, again from Bean Cowpea Crisp, bean varieties in Honduras. An important part of the Bean Cowpea program in Honduras and other parts of the Caribbean has been breeding varieties resistant to the bean gold and yellow mosaic virus. This is a random sample survey that was done in Honduras showing that somewhere in the mid 40% of bean farmers planted resistant varieties. And the economic analysis showed about a 41% annual rate of return. And there's similar studies that have been done in Mexico, in the Dominican Republic, in some other countries. Peanut varieties in Uganda, again, similar story. Peanut Crisp and the NARO, the Ugandan National Ag Research Organization, developed peanut varieties resistant to rosette virus. An ex-ante impact assessment, so that meaning an assessment that's before we know the complete story on adoption, showed a potential benefit of $37 million to $62 million with open economy assumptions. And the main contribution of that particular study is not only to show that there's positive benefit, substantial positive benefit there, but that that benefit disproportionately goes to the poorest farmers because they're the ones who are most likely to benefit from growing those varieties. Hybrid sorghum in Sudan, a little bit of an older study, but again, collaboration between Insermil and the Agricultural Research Corporation in Sudan started in 79. Hugging Dura hybrid sorghum released in 83. A study in the mid-90s estimated adoption from seed sales, which you can do with a hybrid where farmers would have to buy every year. Net present value estimated at $36 million in 1990 dollars, internal rate of return of 97%, even better. And so there's a whole series of these studies from the crop commodity crisps. You know, I contacted all of the crisp management offices. The main ones that came back to me with adoption studies, with well-documented studies of this type were those commodity crisps. Perhaps that's because they've had a longer track record, or perhaps it's easier to measure that. But that's where it seems to be. Training impact, which Herb just talked about, Bean Cowpea Crisp has documented that quite well, and Herb talked about that. To get from numbers of students and their satisfaction to impact, you would need to have some way of linking training to what those students do. What do they do with their training? And there's a long history of this kind of study going back at least to the 1970s, which links economic growth, higher productivity with training. And that's well documented. But it's usually at a national level because that's where the statistics are. To do this at the level of a single crisp would be really very daunting. I mean, the data would be very difficult to collect because crisp trainees do a lot of things with their training. Many of them, at least from Bean Cowpea, continue to work on Bean Cowpea projects, but they may do other things. So they may end up doing breeding for other crops. If they're economists, they may end up doing analysis in other parts of the economy. So training impact, I think we can show that in general. Showing it for a specific crisp is much more difficult. Okay, so there's some of those impact studies that are there. I wish there were more, but if we have them, what do we do with them? One of the things we do with them is they're the foundation for our public relations effort. When we inform people about what we've done, that we know what we've done. We're communicating with donors about what we have done, what we can do. One of the parts of impact assessment that I think has been neglected is using it to improve research management. We can look at, you know, which institutions and which teams are most productive. You know, who has been able to produce impact? Which areas of research yield the most impact? How should CRISP research be organized? You know, is it better to have the old bilateral projects? Many CRISPs have gone to more regional projects. Is that better? The first speaker this morning talked about a more integrated approach. Is that better than an approach that focuses on a specific commodity or a specific problem in production or processing or somewhere else in the value chain? Impact assessment can help us answer some of those questions, noting that, you know, the future doesn't repeat the past. You know, it isn't going to happen exactly the same, but it can help us in understanding what's been productive, what are the areas that are more likely to be successful in the future. A few ideas for increasing CRISP impact. One of them is to focus on key problems. CRISP successes have often occurred where significant resources were concentrated on a well-defined problem. Choice of partners, again, CRISP research and technology transfer has often been more successful when we worked with developing country partners that had as their primary mission technology development and transfer. That we need to recognize that particularly in Africa, most African universities are mainly teaching institutions, and we need to learn to work with them and take advantage of their strengths. In particular, many of them are developing good master's programs that we might incorporate into an overall program. Long-term commitment, I think, has been mentioned here several times, and I'll just re-mention it, that in order to have impact, a longer-term commitment is necessary. Gaps in our knowledge, You know, why haven't the CRISPs measured adoption in many places where they can? Lack of resources, maybe. Impact assessment does cost money, but in the context of a graduate program, makes a very nice master's thesis project, it may not be so expensive. Social scientists are sometimes uninterested in doing impact assessment. It isn't on the cutting edge of their disciplines, and so they're not rewarded professionally for that. And sometimes it can be unpleasant work. Researchers can get very upset if their expectations are not met in an adoption study. We need better measures of nutritional, health, environmental, social benefits, measures that are less expensive, measures that don't require physicians, nurses, or other professionals to take the measurements, measurements that can be summarized over time. And we need to have a better idea how donors and other organizations use that impact data. So, conclusions. I would argue that impact for publicly funded research and education programs, CRISPs or others, must be seen in terms of benefits for large numbers of ordinary people. Quantifying those benefits is important for donor and research decision making. CRISP impact assessment, unfortunately, has been relatively sporadic, often only when good BR is likely to be the result. The crop commodity CRISPs have done more of that impact assessment, at least that I could find, than others. Adoption rates are key. So if you have a limited amount of money to put into impact assessment, do a good job on measuring the adoption rates. And the other things can be done in a less costly way. Random sampling over the whole region of impact is important to get credible adoption. And in my opinion, the greatest shortcoming of CRISP impact assessments is that we haven't always done those adoption studies, even when we could do them, even when there are very clear innovations, technologies that we could have measured adoption on. So, thank you very much, and I think there's a panel after that we do handle the questions.